Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, arts editor at the TLS, and I'm afraid my usual co-host, Alex Clark, is still poorly. So we are sending her lots of get well vibes, and we will talk to her in the new year. But meanwhile, I am delighted again to welcome out from behind the curtain our editor, Charlotte Pardy, who talked to us last week. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm thrilled to be back. What a regular feature I'm becoming.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, last week you told us an eye-watering story about where you get your coffee from, which we won't dwell on again, except just to say that I then heard later on, I was telling someone else about it, so it's a very good story, and someone else said that they had some coffee that someone had brought which had been made by the same method, but this time using weasels, and they never dared to drink it. Weasel sounds worse, doesn't it? Somehow, I don't know why. It's a bit prejudiced of us. But anyway, they didn't dare to try it. I told them that your cat poop coffee was very nice.
Yeah, I loved it. I very much enjoyed it. I haven't drunk it again. I know I've been talking about it a lot, but I haven't drunk it again. Maybe that's because I haven't had the opportunity to. Who knows? Maybe I'll be back reporting that that's all I drank over Christmas. Who knows?
Yeah, you had completely wired because all you did was drink cat poop coffee. So given that this is, in fact, our last podcast of the year, I was going to ask you, Charlotte, if you felt like casting an eye back, and just the one, and thinking about whether there were any sort of highlights of the podcasting year that stuck out for you. And I don't mean none of this is about quality. It's all absolutely wonderful, of course, not better or worse, but just stuff that you remembered or that stuck with you. Was there anything?
Yes, there was. I don't know if you remember an episode that we did quite a few months ago now when we did about the Tour de France.
I wasn't on that one.
Oh,
you
missed
it. I was jealous.
Oh, well.
Because you were talking about the Tour de France.
Yeah, it was fascinating. It was so, so good. And actually, maybe this one because it's the freshest in my mind, but last week with Simon was just a fascinating conversation. And I mean, wasn't that audio extract just phenomenal?
Yeah. Do you know, I was going to say last week's as well, and it sounds silly as we're like, last week's, but it really did. It really did stick out. And a few people have said to me that they liked the interview and also that they liked the audio, that they liked the sound of it, because it did sound really extraordinary. I'm going to try not to take it personally that the first thing you've chosen was one that didn't have me in it. But, you know, that's absolutely fine. That's absolutely fine.
It's not personal, please. It's not personal.
No, honest. Would you like to hear what mine were?
I would love to hear what yours were. What
Thank
were they?
Thank you. You could have just shut me down and said, no, I don't want to hear it. But I'm
going to
tell you
anyway. Be really offended if it's not my first ever appearance on the podcast being last week now.
Yes, of course. That was why. That's why it was a highlight. Nothing to do with Simon McBurney and The Dark is Rising. I was just having a think back about some of the ones that I really kind of enjoyed or stuck out. I loved the Paul Muldoon and Joyce one when he talked us through the first five words, maybe six words of Ulysses and kind of tied them all together for us. I really remember, do you remember the one with Richard Dunn about measuring things?
Yes, that one actually was absolutely fascinating, wasn't it?
Just totally fascinating, because it just seemed as though on the face of it, the book that we were talking about was just kind of about, what measurements do people use throughout the world and blah. And actually, it turns out to be how the world works. The whole world turns on what you choose to measure, how you choose to measure it, who decides what it is, you know. Yeah, that one was really fascinating. Do you remember the one we did with Mary Beard about Roman mementos?
I do. I do. And I actually love a bit of ancient history. So that was fascinating as well. Super interesting.
She basically told us that there was, I think it was it like something like a pen? It was a stylus, I think, maybe. I can't remember it properly. But what it had inscribed on it was, you know, my uncle or whatever went to Londinium. I mean, it's not this, I'm making it up. My uncle went to Londinium and all he brought me back was this lousy pen. It was basically, basically they were doing that too. That was very pleasing to hear. And just another one I remember, just because it was thrilling to talk to him, was Wallace Shawn.
Yeah. It's actually funny when you start to look back, there's just so many brilliant episodes, isn't there, throughout the year? And it's yes, nice to remember them.
We can't really say that anymore, can we? We can't just sit and go, gosh, how brilliant we are. Not us, them. How brilliant all our wonderful guests were.
All our guests are. That is much more appropriate. It is what all our guests are. However, can I just say one of my favourite sort of pieces or things that we do is the gardening chat. I've missed it. Oh. I love it. Yeah, and that we can say is us. It's the only bit we can say is us. And, well, you that guys mainly. But, yeah, no, that gardening.
Well, I'm glad you love it, and I sorely miss it. But if we were doing gardening chat every week, it would just be like, oh, well, the garden's frozen and it looks terrible and I can't do any gardening. But it's a good point. In the new year, things will look up. We can start sowing things and we can start talking about it again and we'll get Alex back and we'll compare gardens. Meanwhile, I need to tell you also what's in the TLS, because we've got a double issue of the TLS, a festive paper. The lead is, it's not all festive, of course, got all sorts of interesting things in it. The lead is a piece by Peter Godfrey Smith, who has written so brilliantly about other minds, particularly the octopus mind. And he reviews two books, one by a man who claimed to have lived in the forest with deer for 7 years, basically as a deer. And there's another one about how the animal closest to us in many ways might be the parrot. So that's kind of interesting. There's a really wonderful long poem by Glyn Maxwell called Wreck, which is very, very powerful and actually really devastating, which might not make you want to read it, but you really should read it because I think it's really wonderful and it will be an important poem, I think. So that's Wreck by Glyn Maxwell. And also the legendary TLS Christmas quiz, where we ask you not to look things up online. And it includes literary quotations on such subjects as toads, shaving, footpaths, definitions of love, all the usual quiz subjects you might expect. But coming up on this week's show, game chips straight from the Aga and bacon butties covered in ketchup. We look at British cooking in idea and reality and Ghosts of Christmas Present. J.S. Barnes takes us on a spooky literary tour of the festive season. So first, if I were to invite you in for Panacelti or a curate's eye, I wonder whether you would be delighted or alarmed. You would, in fact, have no need to fear, unless you're worried about my cooking, which might well be justifiable, because we're talking about food, specifically British food, because this week, Lucy Lethbridge has reviewed the British Cookbook, Authentic Home Cooking Recipes from England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland by Ben Mervis for us. And we're very glad that she's here to talk us through some of the delights on offer. Lucy, many thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You start your piece with some wonderful imagery of the kind of nostalgic stuff people seem to want to see in cookbooks. Do you want to share a bit of that with us?
Well, I think there has been increasingly over the last couple of decades an interest in old-fashioned British cooking. And I think this is part of a sort of general nostalgia for locally sourced, seasonal, slow-cooked, rather kind of heavy, stodgy food. And so you get all things like kind of ox cheek, and big roasts, huge puddings. And I think this is comfort eating, isn't it? And it's part of a feeling that the past was a place of, you know, pre-microwave comfort and solace.
Mm. I love the way that you say about how some of it's presented. Roadkill served on rusty enamel dishes, which I have to say that one sounds even a little bit dangerous rather than appetizing.
It's part of this sort of new macho cooking, isn't it? Where you get people like Fernley Whittingstall and Jamie Oliver, you know, putting their dirty allotment fingers right into the salad.
Or kind of burying a pig for 24 hours, that sort
of thing. Yes, exactly. Or eating a 1,000-year-old egg.
Mm. And there's the other side of it, isn't there? Which is there's another thing you say, which is very evocative. Muffins kept warm in linen napkins on grainy old wooden chopping boards. It's the kind of Aga chic. That's another side of it, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. And it's a kind of nostalgia that seems to come round every 40 years or so. And I'm sure it must be related to there's something in the air, some deep yearnings that somehow seem fulfilled. I was thinking of it when I was looking back at some cookbooks of the early 70s, and you get it there as well. And it's part of that sort of Laura Ashley milkmaid dresses, dressers heaving with mismatched crockery. And then in the 80s, it sort of disappears and we get nouvelle cuisine and we get big white plates and tiny little bits in the middle. And I think it's coming back again, and it clearly reflects, well, it may reflect a kind of social insecurity. There are things in the air which makes us nostalgia for certain old certainties.
Yes. And while we all possibly wishing about hanging around the Argo eating, you know, drop scones, is of course a million miles away from how the vast majority of people actually eat and cook, isn't it?
It is. It's a fantasy, really. And a lot of the recipes in this book, I mean, he has happily interspersed kind of slow cooked ox cheek with very deliciously easy put together things like prawn jalfrezi, which is a sort of newer, obviously a newer kind of recipe. But a lot of the things are uncookable, but that doesn't make them any the less evocative. I mean, it'd be very, very hard for almost anyone to make jellied eels.
I'm sorry to be prejudiced here, but really, why would you?
Well, if there are places out there who will do it for you if you want to go and eat them out. But to jelly your own, I do agree. And it's those little tiny eels. They're not those rather lovely kind of smoked eels that you get in posh fishmongers. They're those little tiny Thames eels. And I don't know where you find them.
Hang around the Thames and then stick them in a bit of gelatine. I did once have jellied eels in a restaurant, and this is completely by the by. Sorry, I just really remember it. And the waitress, I think it was French, said, I said, what are these like? And she basically made a face and went, they're not very nice. And I thought, well, but they're, you know, they're a British delicacy. I'll try them. So kind of basically despite her, turns out very good advice, I ordered it. They weren't cheap either. It wasn't at a jelly, it wasn't a pie and mash shop, which is where you should probably have it. It was this kind of slightly more posh place. Anyway, I had the jelly deals and I've never done this since. They were so unpleasant. I had to just spit them out into my napkin and not eat anything at all. And she had the good grace not to say, I told you so.
My sister had them once. She said they were revoltingly crunchy.
Just everything crunchy and slimy, and as though you had been hanging around the Thames and just put gelatin in your mouth. Anyway, sorry, this wonderful British dish, and I'm sure some people like it.
Well, it's probably very posh now, like a lot of this kind of peasant.
Yeah, probably.
Thing you get in expensive gastropubs, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. Well, more fool me for ordering it. But the author of the book, Ben Mervis, so he knows his market, doesn't he? Tell us about him.
Well, he has a magazine. He's a food writer, and he has a magazine called Fair, which is beautifully produced and very glossy. And it goes to the cities of the world, and it gives you a kind of eatery tour of the food of, you know, say, Lisbon or somewhere lovely. So he's a sort of gastronomic traveller.
But he's not actually born in the UK, is he?
No, he's American. So he brings a kind of outsider's eye to these rather odd dishes that are part of our heritage. But he has, as I say, he has sprinkled in some modern ones. So it is a usable cookbook for those who don't want to jelly their eels. But he clearly loves this sort of poetry, which I think is so beautiful, of the old names, you know, names like Colcannon and Flummery. And there was one I found called O'Scrumpets, which actually sounded absolutely delicious, which is little bits of breaded lamb fried, like sort of lamb goujon. I thought that sounded absolutely lovely. But anyway, they're traditionally called scrumpets, and I imagine that they're made with leftovers. So he loves all that, and he's used as a resource. There's a book that was published about 20 years ago by Laura Mason, which is a kind of inventory of the foods of Britain, and he's used that as a source. And it is incredibly exhaustive on exactly the tiny, minute regional differences in, you know, griddle scones.
Mm. And it's got historical scope as well as kind of geographical.
Yes, he includes a little short essay in the beginning of each section. It's divided into food sections. And at the beginning of each, there is a very broad historical run through. I don't know how useful it would be if you knew quite a bit already, or even if you knew only a little bit, but it sets the scene. It's a little scene setter.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to read in your piece, you say the history of food is the history of human ingenuity. and actually stuff that might be considered as waste, or rather the fear of wasting something?
Well, I think it is, isn't it? And looking through this cookbook, I was really struck by how much is about what's left over. And particularly, I think, and this is particularly interesting now, is, of course, people ate meat far more sparingly. I mean, we tend to think of it being a very meat-heavy diet that we ate 200 years ago. But in fact, actually, meat was extremely sparingly eaten, probably only once a week for people who weren't rich. And therefore, you had to make the leftovers go as far as you could. So things like dripping, which was the leftover fat from the roast on Sunday. And I think that what you see in these recipes is every last scrap has to be used, everything. Sour milk has to be used up, vegetable peelings, turnip tops.
It's probably the sort of cooking we should all be doing right now, basically, to cut down on waste and to save money and not to eat too much meat and all of those things.
I think it is. I think it is exactly the sort of diet we should be following. And it's not as heavy on dairy as you would think. I mean, they're, you know, obviously sort of feasting food is fatty because people had a great deal more exercise. Their houses would have been colder, a lot more sort of manual labor. So you'd need far more calories from saturated fat and dairy. But nonetheless, for the most part, our diet, our daily diet, until relatively recently, it seemed to me, is grain and vegetables, variations of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, perhaps we can, something for us to learn. And so you say for the actual recipes, they do include the sort of things that people might actually make. Could you or would you use this as a practical cookbook?
Yes, you could. I mean, I'm not quite sure who it would be for, because a very accomplished cook is probably going to find these recipes elsewhere in places like Jane Grigson. And the absolutely basic cook, I mean, he tells you how to boil an egg, which he does egg and soldiers, which of course is, you know, it is nursery food. You know, it has a very sort of particular nostalgic appeal. But I'm not sure we need to know how to put toast in the toaster. But
it's quite an easy recipe, isn't it? One egg, one piece of bread.
It's a pretty easy one. But the person who needs to know how to boil an egg isn't going to then sit down and make breaded monkfish cheeks. So I think he's tried to cover all bases. And so it is quite hard to know exactly who it'd be for. I think it's for the bedside table. It's for the kind of lovely meditative opening up and reading about something deeply strange made with something that one probably even wouldn't think of cooking with, and a little bit about its history.
Well, as you said, a lot of the pleasure of learning about the regional variations is the little kind of local quirks. And also you talk about the poetry of the old names of things. Which were your favorites? Which one stood out?
Well, I do love flummery.
Is flummery, so I have not looked this up, and I am genuinely thinking this on the top of my head, is it like a kind of milky Victorian pudding?
Well, it's actually a porridge. It's a form of porridge.
Oh, okay. So no, that's fine.
Every conceivable variation of porridge is to be found here. So yes, actually, if we were looking for an ideal reader, it would be the porridge eater. But the flummery is a sort of oatmeal porridge made with honey and double cream.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
Isn't it? Absolutely delicious. And I just love the name of it. I love everything about it.
It's such a fancy name. I thought it was a kind of delicate syllabubby type thing, but obviously not.
I think it's a sort of real treat. It's a treat breakfast, isn't it?
And you also, I mentioned earlier on panacelti, and what was the other one? A curate's eye, which just sounds alarming.
It's a fried egg in a piece of fried bread with a hole in it. So you fry the egg in the hole in the fried bread.
Brilliant. And that's the curate's eye looking out at you.
Yes. I don't know what it is with curates and eggs.
Yes, there's clearly something going on.
I thought there's a book coming on. Someone has to write that book, The Curate and the Egg.
And what else are you telling us about? A tweed kettle, which is not a tweed kettle. A Scotch woodcock, which is not a Scotch woodcock. And an Orkney brownie.
Yes, which is a ginger cake rather than a brownie. I was quite interested that there are quite a few sort of brownies appear, which must be, I suppose, there must be a cultural memory of that which appears in the brownie, the modern brownie.
Mm. But they're not necessarily chocolate based.
No, they're ginger. A sort of heavy kind of treacly ginger cake.
Right. Okay. I always like the some of the old, I think it's because of Mary Queen of Scots, some of the very old Scottish cooking terms come out of French. They used to say ashit for plate sometimes. And there's another one.
Oh, that's right.
There's another one. I think there's a theory that, you know, there's petticoat tails for the shape of the shortbread.
There's
a theory that that's petit goutel, which I think is a part of the clothing or something. I can't. There's lots of wonderful byways like that that you can go down. Does the book have that kind of thing?
It might do. It's extremely comprehensive. I mean, not in the little essays. He doesn't mention those. But each recipe comes with a tiny little introduction, you know, with sources and derivations and so on.
Mm. And finally, you lament that there's no mention of Parson Woodford. Tell us why that's such a missed opportunity in this case.
He doesn't make very much of literature, which is rather a pity, really, because, you know, eating in fiction, things like Beatrix Potter, you know, cabbage gardens and tables groaning with tea and hot buttered toast and these things. I mean, these really are part of food culture, and he doesn't make much of it at all. And of course, Parson Woodford in his diaries is the greediest of all Englishmen who ever lived.
I've hardly read any. Is he really?
Oh, fantastic. He's so greedy and gluttonous and feasting and has these vast meals. He has, you know, vast lunches, which he has on his travels around his parish. And wherever he stops, he has another vast meal and someone cooks him something. He's marvellous. But there's no mention of him at all, which is a great sadness.
So the thing for us to do is, yes, read this, not for cooking, but by the bedside. And meanwhile, if you want to find out what people were eating, read Parson Woodford. Though I suspect he was very much on the privileged side of what people were eating, wasn't he? He wasn't eating turnip tops.
Yes, and I suppose also being the parish priest, he probably got the, you know, he got the table laid out for him, you know.
Mm.
He got a festive welcome. But, I mean, the difference between... And I suppose that is why cookbooks are not entirely representative of an age, because, of course, recipes that get written down tend to be recipes for feasting rather than for every day. I mean, even today, I mean, someone reading, actually, most modern recipe books wouldn't really give a picture of how we ate every day, because what we eat every day is probably more likely to be something like a microwave meal or beans and toast.
Or bits of everything that's left that you put in a soup and hope it turns out all right, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking from personal experience. But Lucy, many thanks for talking us through this today. Thank you.
It was a great pleasure.
Still to come on the show, Shadows and the Supernatural, we go to the dark side of the festive season. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, if you're feeling fed up of cheery tinsel and bright lights and I wish it could be Christmas every day chiming out of every speaker, then you've come to the right place, because we're going to have a look at the flickering candles, unexplained noises and worse of the season. J.S. Barnes, whose own novels include Dracula's Child and The City of Dr. Moreau, has written about some of the horror-filled delights to be found this month. Jonathan, many thanks for joining us.
Not at all. Lovely to be here.
So you start by talking about M.R. James, arguably the master of ghost stories. Tell us about his story, The Stalls of Barchester Cathedral.
Yes, well, I think I start and finish. I talk about M.R. James, who is, as you say, the master of a certain sort of a very English ghost story that does have this kind of correlation with the season, in part because, you know, how and when he first read the stories. In part, let's be honest, you know, with the BBC television adaptations of the 1970s, The Ghost Story for Christmas, that famous strand. I think the first one, actually, yes, the first one that was filmed in that particular strand was The Treasure of Abbot Thomas. Yeah, which somehow feels particularly festive. It has that great line in it, which I quote at the start of the piece. I find that I absolutely shrink from the dark season.
But don't you start by talking about the stalls of Barchester Cathedral?
Sorry, what did I say? Treasure of Abbot Thomas.
Yes. You did.
Yeah. They all blur into one after a couple of glasses of wine.
Yeah, exactly. Can you talk us through a bit what happens in the stall of Barchester Cathedral?
Yes, the stalls of Barchester Cathedral. That was the first story that was, I think, adapted in the 70s for the BBC by a director called Lawrence Gordon Clark, great television director who adapted the stories as well. Like a lot of the M.R. Jameses, you get any sort of glimpses of the story, and it's sort of filtered through a different narrator and layers of documents and sort of pieced together with, you know, extracts from journals, clippings, things like that, and you sort of build up the story that way. It's about a cleric, Archdeacon Haynes, who becomes gets impatient about his predecessor's longevity in the role. He's very, very pleased to take over the job after his predecessor dies, slightly unexpectedly. And he's not long started when he seems to be kind of afflicted by various odd happenings. We realise he's being haunted by something, and we start to guess there might be a connection between what's affecting him and the sudden demise of his predecessor.
And as you say, it's kind of glanced at, isn't it? It's kind of mentioned and you say, what is it? There's a sound of a cat and there's no cat living there. Someone knocks on the door, but then when he answers, there's no one there. It's all done by suggestion, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all done by suggestion. And James is very good in that story and in others at never joining the dots for you. You know, by far his strongest story. I mentioned in the piece as well, you know, his sort of masterpiece, really, Oh Whistle and I Come to You, My Lad, in which there is never any clear explanation. There are sort of, you know, a disparate range of strange events, and we are invited to make connections on our own. I always think that, you know, if you over-explain the ghost story and you say, you know, this particular person is the ghost of somebody, we know exactly who they are, exactly what they want, you know, it kind of limits the world, I think, and it can make, it makes the story less scary.
Well, it's also that thing of it, then it stays with you. Because if you don't know exactly what happened, you're kind of stuck with it, trying to work out, you know, what it is, isn't it? You talk about a correlation between this kind of ghost story and this time of year.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a very ancient correlation, I think, isn't it? Between the telling of this kind of story and this particular time of year. And indeed, perhaps Christmas. I mean, you started off, you know, saying, you know, if you want a reaction against, you know, Slade and tinsel and all of that kind of rather forced jollity, I'm sure this is part of it, is a kind of reaction against that, isn't it? You know, it's wanting the shadow as well as the light.
Mm. And you were saying about, you know, the nights draw in, you have to light a fire, the wind is howling around the outside. And what did you say? The veil seems a bit thinner than usual.
That sounds like the sort of thing I would write, doesn't it? Yes.
It is the sort of thing you wrote. It's exactly the sort of thing you wrote. And you also say that, so M.R. James absolutely understood this connection to the kind of crouching by the fireside, you know, in the dark or the storm or whatever, and listening to stories, but so too did Dickens.
Yes, and I mean, there is a sort of lineage, isn't there? I mean, James, of course, and both James and Dickens very much understood the power of stories read aloud. You know, James explicitly wrote his short stories to be read aloud to his audience of friends and undergraduates at Cambridge and then at Eton, you know, and Dickens, of course, you know, famously read stories aloud over and over and over, you know, and many, many scholars will say they contributed to his death, don't they?
Because he put so much of himself into them. They were such performances.
That's the story, isn't it? Yes, particularly it's the death of Nancy, isn't it, that he read over and over and he thought taken years off his life. You know, the Dickens ghost story, I think, which is kind of most firmly in that tradition, you know, and feels in some ways like a precursor to the Jamesian stories, is The Signalman.
Mm. Tell us about that story, because it's not a terribly well-known one, I don't think.
I mean, it's obviously not as well-known as A Christmas Carol, kind of what is.
Yes, quite. But actually, I think, weirdly, it is actually quite often forgotten or overlooked that A Christmas Carol really is a ghost story. I mean, that's what it is.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Dickens absolutely knows, you know, how to dial up the spookiness of it. And there are parts of that story, obviously, you know, it's a moral fable, isn't it? Probably more than anything else. But there are certainly bits, you know, which lean hard into the ghost story tradition that Dickens was interested in. But I mean, The Signalman, I think, very late Dickens, that seems to me to sort of throw forward to that kind of, you know, English ghost story of the late 19th century that we think of in particular. And again, you know, going back to what I was saying about things not being explained, I mean, a Christmas Carol, you know, we absolutely understand the moral purpose, don't we, of the ghosts, and we absolutely see their effect on Scrooge. The Signalman, yeah, it feels much more modern in a way, because, you know, there is something going on with time. For, you know, anyone that doesn't know the story, I envy you. Gosh, if you don't know the story of The Signalman, yes, obviously go away and read it. It is about a signalman, very, very lonely job in the, you know, relatively early days of the railways, and he sits in his little shed, and he does his duty to the railway, but he has an awful lot of time to sit alone and think, and also educate himself, Dickens tells us. And he becomes convinced he's seeing, kind of not quite being haunted in a way, but he's seeing glimpses of the future, of some, you know, impending tragedy. And we know that at least a couple of these glimpses subsequently come true. But again, nothing is explained. There's no sort of straight lines drawn between the events. And so, yeah, there's something very, very eerie and troubling, I think, in that late story. Partly came out of Dickens's own experience with a rail crash, of course. So it's kind of haunted by that experience as well.
Yeah, it's got a kind of double haunting. Is that present? I know you went to see this exhibition, To Be Read at Dusk, which is at the Charles Dickens Museum, which is about Dickens and ghosts and the supernatural. Do they talk about The Signalman a lot, or is that touched on there?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the exhibition is well worth a look. It's, you know, I think I say in the piece, you know, its interest is mostly biographical. You know, there is certainly stuff there on A Christmas Carol and Signalman and, you know, the other ghost stories that he wrote, because he was always interested in, you know, think right back to the Pickwick Papers, has got these sort of tales of the supernatural and, you know, the fat boy that wants to make your flesh creep and all of that. The exhibition is probably focuses more on Dickens's own interest in the supernatural, and he was a kind of as people will know, I'm sure he was a kind of sort of hopeful skeptic in a way, but you know, he never found anything which seemed to convince him, I think, of the existence of the supernatural. And you know, he met, you know, many spiritualists and table rappers and people like that, and was kind of fairly scathing ultimately about all of them.
It was almost as though he was trying to get someone who would convince him, and he would go, okay, I believe this one, but he couldn't do it, could he?
It feels like that. And yes, I mean, he had great friendship, didn't he, with William Howitt, who was a writer, but a great enthusiast, almost a sort of evangelist, I think, for spiritualism. And he was keen to find a haunted house. I think one of the reasons the Signalman stands out so much is that Dickens's ghost stories are often quite jokey. You know, there's often a really kind of comic aspect to them, not just Christmas Carol, but others as well. If anyone's, you know, remembers his kind of co-author book, The Haunted House, which was him and Mrs. Gaskell and Wilkie Collins, you know, a sort of pantheon of writers of the day, very sort of what we would now call tongue-in-cheek, I think. But yeah, there was obviously something there that was more serious, wanting perhaps to believe. It kind of, again, he sort of prefigures Arthur Conan Doyle in that respect, and you know, the man that kind of wanted to believe. Obviously, Doyle ultimately goes one way, and Dickens stays very much in the rationalist lane.
Yes, yeah, yeah, because Doyle goes wholeheartedly into it, doesn't he? And
absolutely, yes.
Yeah, 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 and very much wants it to be true. But and from Dickens, you move on to someone much later who you suggest might be a successor to this sort of side of him, the writer Danny Robbins. What's his winter offering this year?
That's a pretty flattering comparison for Danny Robbins.
I think you said it, though, didn't you?
I said in terms of his ghost hunting exploits.
Yes, the ghost hunting, yeah.
Although his play, 222, is highly enjoyable. Yes, no, he's a BBC broadcaster. People may know him from his previous podcast, The Battersea Poltergeist, which I think kind of got a lot of people through lockdown. You know, the timing was absolutely perfect for that, because it came out during the pandemic, an eerie time for different reasons, which was all about this real life case of the 1950s. He does a regular podcast called Uncanny, which looks at various kind of alleged real life hauntings. He's very even handed. He has this sort of, you know, people that have heard the podcast will know he has this kind of very appealing sort of, you know, schoolboyish enthusiasm, but he's very even handed. You know, there's always a skeptic, there was always a believer to filter the evidence. And, you know, there are no spoilers to say that, you know, there is never a consensus reached on any of these cases. The new one's The Witch Farm, which is about this case in Wales, late 80s, 1989 it starts, through to the mid-90s, and not quite a husband and wife. Artist Bill Rich and his then partner Liz move into this, she's pregnant with their first child, move into this remote farmhouse in Wales and become convinced that, you know, the house is set against them, that it's not just haunted. I mean, different kinds of hauntings, aren't there? You know, not just footsteps outside and rappings on the wall, but, you know, some sort of entity that's much more invasive and purposeful.
And malevolent, crucially, isn't it?
And crazily malevolent, yes. Mm. I mean, it's quite a well-known case, and there has been at least one very good book written about it before. But this, I think, will bring the case to a whole new audience. And I think even if you're a real believer, there is, you know, it's kind of an anti M.R. James, really. There is so much stuff that happens. The phenomena are so kind of lurid, and it escalates so far. I mean, something is happening for sure in that farmhouse, whether it's demonic or whether it's something more tragic and more close to home. You know, the podcast leaves, you know, intriguingly open.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I heard snatches of it trailed. I haven't heard it properly, but it's got a very starry cast, hasn't it? I mean, it's very, like, it's a big audio production. I thought it was just a dramatic production. Is that right, or is it not?
No. I mean, they've hit on this. It's Danny Robbins and the audio producer, Simon Barnard. And together they've hit on this, you know, very simple but kind of winning formula. So, you know, Danny, as a journalist, will do the investigation and interview witnesses, and Liz, who was the woman involved, is still with us, and, you know, still swearing blind that all of this happened, and she is there and is extremely persuasive as well. But it's interspersed with these little dramatic kind of excerpts, often, you know, as I said in the piece, necessarily quite expositional, just to give us a little glimpse into the history. Robbins himself is a playwright, so, you know, he's able to write these little snatches that just kind of pepper the discussions. And yes, you know, they always have very good casts. You've got Joseph Fiennes in this, and Alexander Roach, Guy Henry, Rhys Shearsmith, and, you know, Bastia Poltergeist featured Toby Jones, for example, amongst others. So yeah, it's always an excellent cast, and it kind of needs to be, I think, you know, it needs to be a really good cast to sell these little moments of drama. It's hugely entertaining. It's great fun. Particularly in this one, there's a strand of something kind of sadder and darker as well. So yeah, I mean, it's perfect winter listening.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, to come back full circle, we are coming back, in fact, to M.R. James and A Teller of His Tales. Tell us about the Nunky Theatre Company.
I'm sure plenty of listeners will know about Nunky already. If not, again, you know, hugely recommended. Yeah, Nunky Theatre Company is one man, Robert Lloyd Parry, who tours the country, really does tour all over the country at this time of year, late autumn and winter, just after Christmas. And what he does is very simple on one level, and, you know, kind of its brilliance lies in its simplicity, really. He performs by heart and often by candlelight a huge range of M.R. James stories. I went actually to Cambridge and I saw him a couple of days ago performing two stories. He chooses these very interesting venues, sort of crumbling manor houses, kind of rickety theatres, occasionally like a little room above a pub. On this occasion, in this beautiful church in central Cambridge, all the lights were turned out, a very small audience. You know, he doesn't allow an audience that's often much more than sort of 30, 40, 50 people.
Oh, really? So that's small enough to feel intimate and as though you're not at a play, as though you are just all listening to it together.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, and often for that reason, these events sell out very, very quickly. And yeah, he will perform, you know, in character as M.R. James, two or three of his stories. And there's nothing beyond that. There are no effects. He might have the odd prop, you know, there were no other actors, there's no music. It is just pretty much as James would have done it. You know, it's the story told by heart, and the power of the writing and the power of these stories is kind of brought over anew, really, when he performs them in this way.
And what our listeners don't know is that while Jonathan was talking about the power of storytelling and how spooky it all was, my connection broke. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means anything, but thanks to the magic of editing and Charlotte, our editor, here I am back again. Jonathan, thank you so much for telling us about all this spooky Christmas stuff. Do you actually enjoy a bit of Christmas horror?
Yes, I absolutely love it.
Okay, just all the year round, even in August, or, you know.
Well, I mean, and this is such a great time of year, isn't it? It's inextricably linked for me with ghost stories and has been for years. So, yeah, it's time to be relished.
It is to be relished, and then, you know, turn the lights on and kind of give yourself a shake and see where you are. The thing that we should mention, actually, is that the Nunky Theatre Company, they also have, well, he has an event that they do on Christmas Eve, doesn't he? Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, I believe this has been a tradition for a couple of years. Yeah, I mentioned, gosh, the pandemic earlier, and during that period, you know, he did quite a lot online for obvious reasons. But something that stuck, yeah, is the Christmas Eve tradition of reading a ghost story. It's 7 o'clock, I think, on Christmas Eve. It is on Zoom, so you have to be responsible for creating some of your own atmosphere, I think, you know, and lighting a candle and turning the lights out and all of that. And he's performing this year The Treasure of Abbot Thomas, which is a particularly nasty M.R. James story for Christmas, and one of my favorites. So yeah, I'll certainly be tuning into that.
Okay, and you said in your piece of interesting thing, you said that the Zoom, or the sort of Zoom meeting, what do you call it? You call it an eerie invention in its own right, often reminiscent of a Victorian seance. So do you think, weirdly, it is quite an appropriate medium?
Weirdly, yes, I think so. Yes, I mean, well, as you've just seen, there is something spooky about Zoom and people dropping them out and you know, you can sometimes sort of see glimpses of their faces moving and no sound emerging, and then they all freeze, and you're constantly saying, you know, are you there? Are you there? Is anybody there? Reaching out into the darkness. So yeah, there's definitely an overlap.
Rapping the table or yes. clicking the mouse to try and find out what the heck yes. is going on. Brilliant. Well, now we know what to do for a spooky Christmas Eve. Jonathan, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. A pleasure.
That is all we have time for this week, and in fact this year. Our thanks go to Lucy Lethbridge and J.S. Barnes. And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast and any others you might have listened to, produced by the wonderful Charlotte Pardee. We will be back in January, but for now, goodbye and have a happy holiday.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.